Welcome back, everybody. With us is attorney Ken Levine, who concentrates his practice on obstetrical malpractice cases. This is Frank Riccio, and I am hosting the show, and I will be actually for the upcoming months, once a month on medical malpractice issues. Ken, we're talking about screening these cases and talking about experts. And one of the things in a shoulder dystocia case is that not only do you need an expert on the standard of care, you also need an expert on the causation and injuries. Could you explain that to the audience?
Oh, sure. The standard of care, when we try these cases, what the juries are asked to do is decide whether the doctor has followed the standard of care. What it just really means is, did a doctor do what every other qualified doctor should do? It's not as confusing as it sounds. So when we look at the cases, we have to find out several things. First, did the doctor do something incorrectly? Like in these cases, you know, pull too hard on these babies' heads. Did they do something, not do something they should have done, which would be recognize the risk? And then we have to make sure that the negligent act, what they did wrong, links to the injury. So for these cases, we talk to obstetrician gynecologists, sometimes midwives, depending if it's a midwife who delivered the baby, sometimes nurses, if they're involved in delivery also. But then also we talk to surgeons and pediatric neurologists, because those people help us understand the nerves and how much pulling a nerve can sustain. So there's a wide range of people that get involved. And again, as I said, it's the fail-safe system, because we need to consult all these different experts before we can take a case. And unless we get the support of all these people, we can't take the case. And it's the protection the doctors have against us filing cases that aren't realistic and good cases.
I mean, it sounds almost Darwinian in the sense that before a case even becomes a lawsuit, there's a lot of work involved in terms of putting it together. And so the screening actually starts before doctors don't even know many times that there may be a potential claim against them. And so part of what your function is to screen the case to make sure it doesn't go forward unless it's really legitimate.
Right. Oh, absolutely. There's an old the old lawyer's wives' tale is that if you do your job correctly, that the day you actually file the case in court to begin the case, you should really almost have your case all prepared. You should have the experts prepared. You should have the case prepared. And you shouldn't even file the case unless you could actually go to trial the next day, in a sense. So, yeah, there's a lot of work done to get to the point where we could even start a case.
And it doesn't end there, does it?
No, not at all. Because then, in the old days, Frank, and unfortunately our hair is too gray, but we remember these days. In the old days, there used to be things, trial by surprise. But for the past 30 years, we have rules of court that control what we do. And in the middle period of a case, once we actually begin the case and before the trial, in the middle part of a case, we have tools we use to get information. We can send written questions, and we can ask for documents, and we can take depositions. And during that period, we're learning much more information. And we may have a medical record that tells us some things. But now in this middle period where we can take depositions, we're learning how things may have been apart from the record. So, and we're also working with our experts still, telling them, well, we've learned new information. So it's a very, very, very busy ongoing process.
And there's also a procedural rule that there's a statute or a law that basically gives additional protection to all medical care providers called the Medical Malpractice Tribunal System, which is utilized to actually screen out frivolous cases. Ken, how does that work?
Well, you know, we do, as you mentioned, we do work around the country. And I can tell you that our screening process here in Massachusetts is as strict as any in the country. Some states, before you can file a case, just ask that you write a note to the court saying you've talked to an expert. That's all you have to do. In this state, after a case is filed, the court convenes a hearing. It's a doctor, a lawyer, and a judge. And we have to actually go to this hearing, present the medical records, and we must bring an affidavit or a letter from a qualified, board-certified medical expert who includes in his letter that a doctor made a mistake, what the mistake is, and that the mistake caused the harm to the child. If we don't have this letter, we will not get through this tribunal hearing, and there's a $6,000 bond that's ordered to be paid by the plaintiff, and if they don't pay the bond, the case is dismissed. So our screening process here is as strict as any in the country.
Now, assuming you win the tribunal, do you win? Is that it? The case settles? Is it over?
No. We wish it was true. But no, all that means is that the court has found that there's an issue worthy of argument. The tribunal is not saying we should win the case or we should lose the case. What they're saying is that there is enough of an issue that they think the case is worthy to proceed along and maybe go to a jury trial at some point.
So basically, after all that, basically, you get to start it go again.
Yes, you do. It's a requirement in the state, and a good one, because it's a protection for the doctors. It's also a protection for the courts, that they can weed out frivolous cases early on and not have to have them clog up our system. But it doesn't mean win or lose. It just means, as you said, you can pass go and continue working.
And what does that consist of? In other words, you've won the tribunal. You feel you're in pretty good shape. What's the next impediment?
Well, after the trial, in this state, we don't usually take the depositions before the tribunal. It's not a rule, but a tradition, which is changing a little bit because of time, but that's been our tradition. So after the tribunal, usually things get ramped up. We'll take the depositions of all the doctors and nurses and also of the injured parents. Usually the children are too small to be asked questions. And then we're moving along to secure the experts for the trial. They may be the same ones we've spoken to early on in the case. They may not be, but we've got to secure them. And then eventually there's a conference with the court to set a trial date, and then we're off to the trial.
And this is typically a jury trial?
In Massachusetts, very, very, very few cases of medical malpractice cases will not be jury trials. Almost 90, I would say 99%.
And besides jury trials, there are also other options that may work called alternative dispute resolution. What does that mean?
Well, sometimes, there's risk in everything. And the insurance companies for the physicians who we really deal with, I mean, the reality is, I know we're talking about medical malpractice cases, we're talking about doctors, but in reality, their insurance company is who we deal with mostly because they're the ones controlling the money. Sometimes when they're concerned that they might lose the case, rather than take a chance, they'll suggest we go to mediation with a retired judge.
And what is mediation?
Well, we'll go and meet for a day with a retired judge or with a qualified mediator, and we'll try to settle the case. There's usually a demand for settlement made with a certain dollar amount that we'll ask for. The response, as you know, is usually zero. And then we spend a day trying to see if we can find some settlement number that's acceptable to all sides. And then there's also something called arbitration where we can select, usually again, a retired judge, and we can actually try the case over a period of a few days, and the decision of that judge is binding as if it were a jury trial. That's sometimes done, not as often. Mediation is more popular.
And mediation, in my experience, has always been a much more humane process for all involved. The doctor typically doesn't show up, and the plaintiff at least has his or her day in court without having to really go to court. Has that been your experience as well?
It is. The good mediators, the ones that actually know what they're doing, make sure to give the injured parents, in the case of the babies that are hurt, to give the injured parents a good chance to talk about what their life is like and to express themselves. The good mediators do that very well. And, it's not always about the money. Sometimes, the parents, they see their child struggle. They see their child struggling with the brain damage kids, certainly, and also in the brachial plexus cases where they can't use an arm or two. And they need to speak to someone. They need to explain themselves to someone, and that's often what happens at mediation.
And the other good part about mediation is that it's a more informal in the sense that you don't have to comport with the rules of evidence,
right,
which you do have to comport with at trial.
Right.
And a typical trial on a shoulder dystocia case, How long does that usually take?
Well, it depends. The courts sometimes sit odd times. I know it sounds strange for people who don't have their experience with the system, but sometimes in Massachusetts, we actually have jury trials that sit from 9 o'clock in the morning till 1 in the afternoon, and then judges in the later afternoon will hear other motions of things. So if you're sitting from 9 till 1, you can sometimes take 2 or 3 weeks to try these cases because you only get so many hours of testimony per day.
And typically there are multiple experts on both sides. Is that correct?
There are. The most difficult thing, Frank, the most difficult part of all of this, and this is the system we have, and it's a system that we all know is the best in the world, but the most difficult part is that we select 12 jurors to come in from their local area. They don't have medical training and background. And then we expect these 12 people to learn complex medical issues in the span of a week or two, and it's tough on the jurors. We as lawyers, being in the system all day, have so much appreciation for the ability of jurors to learn and listen during these trials because it's very, very tough to do in these complex cases.
It is. I find that amazing. I also find that jurors put a certain common sense into the whole analysis, and you know, I find that at least a lot of trials that I've done, that the juries do get the issues. Costliness. All right, you do a trial, a shoulder dystocia trial. What's it going to run? Not even counting the contingency fee, which is all the lawyer time. What does it run typically in terms of costs, in terms of hiring experts? From beginning to end.
Now, I'll digress for one more moment because I think these are important things for people to know. One other reason why there's a fail-safe that protects physicians is the cost. Now, in order to pursue a complex birth injury case, my firm might invest $65,000, $75,000, $80,000 of our own money, money that if the case loses, we are not going to see again. We lose the money and we don't get paid. So if we take cases that are not seriously good cases that aren't real cases, we run the risk of losing our own money and not being paid. And again, that cost analysis is another reason why doctors should feel safer knowing we just can't take frivolous cases or not cases that aren't very good.
When we come back, we are going to talk about brain injury cases and catastrophic brain injury cases. So we'll see you right after this news message. Thank you.